Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Once again, pleased to be with you this Sunday morning. On today's program, we've got a lot of culture couched into two segments later in the program and an update on a young person featured in our graduating Latino series. You may remember that from a couple of years ago. Up first, last week on this program, we heard from the organizers of this year's Free to Breathe Dayton 5K Run Walk for Lung Cancer. The annual event returns to the Dayton Raceway at Hollywood Gaming on Saturday, September 8th. We continue our coverage today with a man who has his own story to share. Dr. John Fleischman is an ophthalmologist practicing in Dayton. He lost his wife, Dr. Jill Rossett, to lung cancer in April of 2017. He talked to us about how that has directed his life today.
My wife was a very smart woman, but she had one weakness, and her weakness was cigarettes. She started smoking at the age of 15, and by the time I met her, she was an addicted smoker. She promised me before we got married several times that she would quit smoking, and she didn't, and so I married her anyway. And so finally, after many years of my pestering her and her attempting to quit, she tried to quit many, many times. In 2013, I was talking to her, and I said, "Honey, I haven't seen you have a cigarette lately. What's the story?" And she said, "Well, I quit 3 years ago. I was wondering when you would recognize that." And I said, "My goodness, that's wonderful." And she had actually stopped on our anniversary, April 27th of 2010. So this was 3 years later. My wife was not one for going to doctors, and she hadn't actually seen a physician in 25 years. And this is a very bright, board-certified pathologist. So in 2013, she decided that she wanted to get screened for cancer. And so she saw her family doctor and had a mammogram, pap smear, colonoscopy, and such, but it wasn't recommended that she have a lung cancer screening. So in December of 2016, Jill had a little bit of pleuritic chest pain. She had some pain on breathing following a rather heavy exercise. We were hiking in the mountains in Virginia, and we got a chest x-ray, and she had a massive tumor involving the right lower lobe of her lung, and 3 months later, she passed away from the cancer, which ultimately spread into her heart and killed her. So this experience led me into looking into a little bit more about cancer in the United States and who dies from what types of cancer. And if you look at the rates of cancer death in the United States, about 50,000 people a year die from colon cancer. About 40,000 people a year in the United States die from breast cancer. Another 30,000 die from prostate cancer. You add those three together and you don't get close to the number one cancer killer, and that's lung cancer, which kills each year in the United States over 160,000 people. And you look at the 160,000 people who die from lung cancer as a group, 80% of them are smokers. So here we have a self-selected segment of the population which is at very high risk for the deadliest of all cancers, that being lung cancer. And we look at the screening rates for lung cancer, and we find that very few patients are actually being screened for lung cancer. I dug into this a little bit deeper. I didn't have to dig too deep because all this stuff is public information. And in 2011, the results of the National Lung Screening Trial became available. This was a multi-center study that was conducted across the United States at 33 centers. They looked at 53,000 patients, all of whom were heavy smokers, over the age of 55 and had smoked for at least 30 pack years and had smoked within the last 15 years. That was the criteria for being included in the study. The other criteria being not having had cancer before diagnosed and not being asymptomatic from a pulmonary standpoint. So they randomized these 53,000 former heavy smokers into two groups. One group would get a chest x-ray each year for 3 years, and the other group would get a low-dose chest CT. And what they found was after 3 years, there was a 20% reduction in the mortality rate in the patients who had received a low-dose chest CT. As a result of the published data from the National Lung Screening Trial, in 2012, the American Association of Thoracic Surgeons, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, the American Lung Association, and the National Comprehensive Cancer Network made the following recommendations. All patients over the age of 55 years of age who had smoked for the last 15 years smoked at least 30 pack years. And what a pack year is, if you smoke one pack a day for a year, that's a pack year. If you smoke half a pack a day for 2 years, that's one pack year. So patients over the age of 55, 30 pack years, and smoke within the last 15 years. Those national organizations all recommended that the patients between the age of 55 and 77 should have a yearly low-dose chest CT as an effective screening tool for lung cancer. In 2013, the United States Preventative Service Task Force and the American Cancer Society made the same recommendation. And in 2015, Medicare finally came on board and decided that they would recommend the screening for patients who are at risk and that they would reimburse for it. However, in 2013, the American Academy of Family Practice made a statement that they did not feel that the data supported or did not support lung cancer screening, so they were neutral on it. And as a result of this recommendation, I think primary care doctors are not screening for lung cancer. This is borne out by the evidence. In 2015, of the 6.8 million Americans who met the criteria for lung cancer screening, 30 pack years over the age of 55, smoked within the last 15 years, only 4% were screened. That was in 2015. The following year, the same 6.8 million Americans, only 2% were screened.
Why do you think there's such a disparity in the required screening?
I have to tell you, this has been a big shock for me, and it's been a big shock discovering this among many of my other physician friends who are surgeons primarily. There's no money to be made in lung cancer screening. A chest CT at my hospital, I'm president of a physician-owned hospital here in town, and we offer lung cancer screening, a low-dose chest CT, and the hospital makes $100 off the test. Whereas if you look at mammography and certainly colonoscopy, these are multi-billion dollar a year industries, and there's a lot of money being made and fortunes being made off of screening for breast and colon cancer. And I think the number one issue for not screening for lung cancer is a very strong anti-smoker bias among physicians. And frankly, I hate to say it, but it's true. You smoked, you knew the risks, so I'm sorry, but tough luck. And I think that's very prevalent among primary care doctors. And they also have the ability to hide behind the American Academy of Family Practice being neutral on lung cancer screening, despite very good science to the contrary. And there's the old orthodox, lung cancer is, by the time we find it, it's too late. And there's several reasons for this. The lung is a perfect breeding ground for cancer, and you have a lot of redundant lung tissue. A lot of patients can live with just one lung and live quite easily. So the tumor is allowed to become very large prior to the patient becoming symptomatic, and that's why screening is so important. And that's why lung cancer is so deadly, is the fact that the tumor is very large by the time it's diagnosed in most cases with only a 17% 5-year survival rate. The incidence of lung cancer in this country is not much greater than the incidence of colon cancer, but it's 4 times as deadly. And the reason why it's 4 times as deadly is we're not screening for it. And by the time it's found, it usually is too late. So we have hard data, a huge study which supports lung cancer screening on a yearly basis for patients at risk, and it's very important that physicians start doing this.
How do you get that movement going?
Well, I'm getting it going by being on your show today, and I'm being very proactive in my own practice. I see about 200 patients a week, and I have determined in discussing with my patients each one that about 15% of my patients are at risk for lung cancer over the age of 55 and have 30 pack years or more smoking. What the National Lung Screening Trial demonstrated, one of the data points that they came up with, was that if you screen that at-risk population, if you screen 300 patients, you'll save one life. So if I see 200 patients a week in a very busy practice, and 15% of those patients are at risk for lung cancer and should be screened, and I work for 48 weeks a year, that's around 10,000 patients. You divide that number by 300, and if I don't screen, five patients will die. If I do screen, I'll pick up five lung cancers. So I think it's incumbent on every physician to screen their patients for cancer.
Doctor, can you explain a low-dose CT scan?
A low-dose chest CT is a scan, computerized tomography of the chest using the minimal amount of radiation possible. And the amount of radiation is about 1.5 millisieverts per test. Just to give you an example, just living here on Earth, you receive about 3 to 4 millisieverts per day, per year rather. So it's a very low dose X-ray, and it gives a very high resolution view of the chest, and is very effective in picking up small nodules.
And you're actually doing lung cancer screenings.
Yes, I am. And I'm encouraging my fellow physicians to do so as well, some of whom are general surgeons and some of whom are gynecologists who see patients and, of course, get a complete history on their patients and now know who's at risk and who should be scanned. I'm president of the Medical Center at Elizabeth Place, a small physician-owned community hospital that is in the old St. Elizabeth facility. And we've been present there for about 11 years, and we do have a CT scan and an MRI scanner. And we are screening patients for lung cancer with low-dose chest CTs. And the phone number for the Medical Center at Elizabeth Place Radiology Department for patients who are interested is 660-8774, 660-8774. That patients who are at risk, who meet that criteria for having Medicare or other insurance companies pay for a low-dose chest CT, should take up the issue with their primary care doctor. But they also should be aware that in this one instance, they may need to be the advocate, because I've had a number of my patients go to their family doctors and request low-dose chest CT scanning for lung cancer, and the doctors are ignorant of it and actually argue with the patients, and the patient has to get the doctor to become educated in this regard, which is really a pretty sorry situation when you think about the fact that 160,000 people a year die from lung cancer.
Dr. Fleischman, can you tell me what drives your advocacy?
Well, my advocacy is for my patients. And frankly, I don't want anyone to have to go through what my wife went through. And there was no reason for a lot of patients, including my wife, to die from lung cancer. Lung cancer at this point in our current state of technology is a very treatable disease. But like any cancer, whether it's colon, breast, brain, pancreatic, or prostate, early diagnosis is key. And if we don't screen these patients, and we have very, very strong evidence with multi-center studies showing that screening is effective, if we don't screen them, then hundreds of thousands of people continue to die who could have been saved. So that's the reason for my pushing for lung cancer screening.
Well, best of luck to you and the work that you're doing, and thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Dr. John Fleischman, he says he's written a letter to the American Academy of Family Practice in an effort to get them to join the other medical associations he spoke of in endorsing the use of more low-dose CT scans to detect lung cancer earlier. And as president of the Medical Center at Elizabeth Place, the small physician-owned community hospital, he's encouraging other doctors to step up efforts in early lung cancer screening and detection. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. Miami Valley College students are returning to campus for fall term, but for some area young people, going to college presents an extra challenge because they are undocumented immigrants. 3 years ago, WISO met one such young person as part of our graduating Latino series, a then junior at Ponce Career Technology Center that we called Javier, who had hoped to attend college here in the Miami Valley. Today, we catch up with Javier and his family. Community Voices producer Jonathan Platt visited with them and brings us this update.
It's Saturday night, and we are having dinner with Javier's family. They're serving cuy, an Ecuadorian staple, barbecued guinea pig.
It does not look delicious.
But Javier and his little sister, Maria, say that they would rather be munching on the IHOP pancakes she brought home from her job. Javier and Maria have lived in Dayton for 8 years, nearly half of their lives. Their parents came to America first from Ecuador and eventually decided to bring their children here using a series of smugglers commonly called coyotes. 5 weeks and 3,000 miles later, they were together as a family for the first time in years. Javier and Maria enrolled in Dayton Public Schools. When Javier was a senior at Ponce, he made straight A's and was offered a scholarship to attend Sinclair Community College. But something happened.
I was shocked because I saw the amount that I had to pay. Uh-huh. And when I went out to eat with my friends and I told them that, they were like, but why? Because I only had to pay $1,000 because I didn't have any scholarships. And I was like, but how did you do it? She was like, I just showed them that I was a Montgomery County resident.
Javier is not considered a Montgomery County resident because he does not have a Social Security number. The IRS gave him a 9-digit code for college applications, but that only verifies his tax status as a student. It doesn't give him access to tuition pricing for local residents, and it means he can't accept the scholarship money he was offered.
It's kind of ridiculous. He can go out and work and pay taxes, but he can't get the benefits to go out and do the other things. That makes no sense to me.
That's auto mechanic instructor Rick Seether, Javier's former high school teacher, mentor, and friend. He's now teaching Maria in his morning automotive class.
Do you think you're into this as much as your brother was?
Probably not. I would say my brother was more into it because he's like been with cars ever since he was like a little boy. Uh-huh. And I wasn't. I was all about since I was little, I wanted to be a veterinarian, but I got into cars now.
And still into that work?
If I go to college, probably I might let it work. But if I don't, then nah. I might just stay working with cars, helping my brother out.
Maria's skill set as a mechanic is not as specific nor polished as her older brother's. And she knows it. Javier has moved his way up in the auto mechanic world and is now at a garage that does advanced work, such as rebuilding transmissions. As part of his work, he gets to drive, but his undocumented status means he can't get a driver's license. If Javier drove a car outside the garage, he could be pulled over, detained, and deported back to Ecuador. This almost happened to his father, Juan. In 2012, he was pulled over in a van with other undocumented workers. A lawyer told him to file for asylum, but Juan didn't tell the lawyer about his family because he did not want to put them in jeopardy. He had no idea what would happen.
He said, if I tell them something about us, they might come later and get all of mm-hmm. us. And my dad wasn't care of that. He said, if I want asylum, I just want it for myself. If I don't get it, I'm just going to be kicked out mm-hmm. the country, just me, not my family.
Javier and Maria have no legal status in the United States. They would not have qualified for DACA because they arrived in the U.S. a few years after the cutoff year, 2007, set by the Obama administration. Javier still has dreams beyond the garage. He's saving his money and still plans to go to Sinclair, but he'll have to pay the full out-of-state tuition every term. With books, that's about $8,000 a year. As Maria watches her brother plan, she is not sure if higher education is for her.
I'm not really quite sure if I'm going to go to college again because he has that problem, so I might have that problem too. He has a good job. He's working on it to get to college, I work at IHOP for like 3 days a week. Yeah. I don't make that much money, so I'm not quite sure if I'll go to college either.
Immigration lawyers say that the family does not have a clear path to American citizenship. So for now, both Maria and her brother will continue to navigate their education and future as undocumented workers. For WISO, I'm Jonathan Platt.
To hear WISO's original Graduating Latino series from 2015, you can visit our website at wyso.org. Well, in the late 1800s, a rural roadside advertising tradition began when mail pouch tobacco signs were painted on barns in Ohio and West Virginia. The signs said, "Chew mail pouch tobacco," and they were commonplace. More than 12,000 barns were painted with that message in bold letters. The men who painted those signs were known as wall dogs, barn lizards, and barn massagers. But over time, and in response to highway beautification legislation, much of their handiwork was painted over. On this episode of County Lines, producer Renee Wild meets a man who is helping revive the art of barn painting.
Traffic is rushing along State Route 81, a few miles east of the city of Lima. Just a stone's throw off this busy highway, Scott Hagen is using a small paintbrush to outline the words, "Welcome to Allen County," across the side of a large red barn. Hagen is known as the barn artist, and he just might be one of the last remaining people to carry on this rural tradition. Hagen never considered himself an artist growing up, and he has no formal art training. But one day when he was 19, he decided to paint a picture of the Tasmanian Devil on the side of his dad's barn in Belmont County.
I told Dad about it. And I went in to get the ladder, and I was setting up my ladder, and he was mowing the pasture just below the barn. And while I'm putting the ladder up, I heard him shut down the mower and the tractor, and in a real calm voice he said, "Hey, I don't want a devil in my barn." So I think it took another week or two to go back to the drawing board to figure out, well, what can I paint? I want people to like it. So I painted the Ohio State Buckeye, Blocko, and Brutus mascot on the barn.
Since then, Hagen has hand-painted custom designs on 600 barns in Ohio and around the country. When he was first starting out on this career path, he sought the advice of another Belmont County resident, Harley Warwick, a man who was famous for painting the iconic mail pouch tobacco signs on rural barns throughout the country. Warwick showed Hagen the ropes of being a barn painter, literally.
He was real gracious about talking to me about the scaffolding and the type of equipment that he was using. And so that was really nice to get to meet him, and he showed me the ropes and pulleys and how they were doing things, how he did things, how to tie the knots quickly. And so for about a year and a half, I used the rope and pulleys like he did.
Just as Hagen's career was starting up, Warwick was coming to the end of a long life, so the two never really got to trade too many stories. Only around 100 of Warwick's hand-painted mail patch tobacco barns remain, and are now listed as historic landmarks in Ohio. Hagen is pleased to carry on the barn advertising tradition, even as the rural landscape is changing.
A lot of what I'm doing, they're not working farms anymore. I mean, some are, some aren't, but more and more, it's just a building that people happen to own, and that's a little bit sad to see. But it's really fun and enjoyable time when it's still a working farm. People are using it for farming. I was just in Connecticut a couple weeks ago and doing two silos, and I painted a flag on the guy's barn. But they own a ice cream shop. But meeting the folks there and what they do, making the ice cream, the brother is still running the farm. He's 60 years old, and he's out baling hay, square bales by himself. I jumped on the wagon one day just to help him for an hour, just to say I did it, you know. But we still text almost daily now, "Hey, how are you doing?" And he'll ask me how things are in Ohio, and it's so much fun to meet the people. Outside of barn painting, one of my favorite things to do is I do a lot of work for schools and their gymnasiums. I really like doing those because I get to transform the gym. High school gyms, and especially a lot of the areas I work, especially in the rural area, it is really the center focal point of the community. It's where everything happens. And the sense of pride that goes into that, and And that's what the gym is. It's a pride of the community.
Hagen's come a long way from the kid who wanted to paint a cartoon character on the side of his family barn. For the past 20 years, his work keeps him crisscrossing Ohio and all over the U.S., as traditional barn advertising is experiencing a small resurgence in popularity.
You know, I'd like to say I had a big part of the resurgence in a sense. I think one reason why I've been busy is because no one really uses a brush anymore. No one else wants to do that type of work. Those days are just gone. I mean, it can be printed. It's faster and probably more economical, and it's just easier for the most part. But what I do is just a lot different.
For County Lines on WYSO, Renee Wild, Lima, Ohio.
In 2017, legislation was passed to designate the barn as Ohio's official state historical architectural structure. To see photos of the barn from this story or to hear more stories from the County Line series, visit our website at wyso.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us. Next week, the World House Choir in Yellow Springs presents the Ohio premiere of a new choral work called The Man Behind the Dream. It's the story of Bayard Rustin, a gay African-American Quaker and civil rights activist. Rustin taught King the practice of Gandhian nonviolence and organized the 1963 March on Washington. Yet most people don't know his story. Culture Couch producer David Seitz has this story about the choral work that honors Bayard Rustin's life and work.
Cincinnati composer and longtime choral director Steve Malloy found his role model late in his life.
During that time, I've sung or heard of works for Matthew Shepard, done works about Harvey Milk, and I kept thinking, when am I going to sing a work about somebody who looks like me, who represents where I stand in the world?
When he learned about Bayard Rustin, he knew.
Community, a group of angelic troublemakers.
That's Bayard Rustin with one of his most famous quotes about nonviolent resistance. Malloy knew he wanted to musically tell Rustin's story. So a few years later, he spoke to Jane Ramsire Miller, who grew up a lesbian in the Mennonite Church and directs One Voice, a GLBTQ choir in Minneapolis.
And he said to me, "Have you ever heard of Bayard Rustin?" And I said, "Yes, I have." And Steve said, "I want to compose a major work." And I said, "Yeah, I'll commission it. I'll raise the money and figure out how to do it."
Before Rustin became an activist in the 1940s, he was a professional singer in New York. Rustin's biographer, John D'Amelio, explains that Rustin saw music as part of activism.
Effortlessly, he would move from giving a talk to suddenly singing a song that was designed to rouse everybody's spirit and pull them together.
In the 1940s and 50s, Rustin worked in the labor, peace, and civil rights groups that led to the activism of the 60s. He took all that work with him when he was imprisoned as a war resister in World War II.
In federal prison, he was Bayard Rustin, so he didn't just sit in his cell. He began organizing prisoners against racial segregation. In order to stop him, federal prison officials brought him up on sex charges.
Rustin understood that when he would get into trouble for being gay, his actions posed a liability for the movements that he worked for.
And so Rustin actually had to strategize and think about how to be an effective leader and really make a difference in these movements without the attention focusing on him.
In the 1960s, civil rights leader Adam Clayton Powell threatened to spread rumors that Rustin and Martin Luther King were lovers if Rustin didn't leave the movement. It's a complex story.
So it was hard in setting this up to figure out how do you talk about what happened with the movement, being willing to let this man go.
For Malloy, the story required different musical styles, such as ragtime, gospel, and jazz that reflected Rustin's complex actions. The song Stick in the Wheel depicts Rustin's practice of nonviolence.
The only weapon we have is our bodies. and we need to tuck them in places so wheels don't turn.
So I really kind of just wanted some kind of slinky jazz piece, you know, that felt like you kind of sneaking in to different corners and into different spots and stopping things. And that's where there's a lot of ba-da-da-da. There's a lot of stop time in the piece.
But Malloy's score also captures Rustin's sexuality in a tango.
Bayard loved men, and he did not hide that fact. And he got in trouble and got arrested for it. The tango was basically a kind of a bittersweet love song, which actually turns into a song of defiance and triumph.
Finally, the choral work leads us to Black Lives Matter, a movement started by three African-American queer lesbians.
And a number of the audience members said to me, I didn't expect to be brought to the present. I didn't expect to have so much hope and be moved to action today.
The Man Behind the Dream will be performed next week in Yellow Springs, Dayton, and Cincinnati. For Culture Couch, this is David Seitz.
For additional concert details, visit WISO.org and tune into Excursions on September 4th when Nikki Dakota will talk to World House Choir Director Dr. Kathy Roma about this performance. And we've got more culture coming at you. Some of the greatest photographs of our time were taken by one man, an Armenian refugee who fled to North America and rose to international fame. This summer, his timeless collection of photographs from the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. is on display here at the Dayton Art Institute. Community Voices producer Leo DeLuca has the story about Yousef Karsh.
A scowl, his hand on his hip. This is often the first image that comes to mind when people think of Winston Churchill. It was taken by photographer Yousef Karsh. Here's his 88-year-old widow, Estralita Karsh, on the phone from Boston.
That was the international breakthrough of his career.
It is now one of the most widely reproduced photographs in the world. But when Karsh took that portrait, he was a displaced 32-year-old photographer living in Ottawa.
My husband was in the Armenian massacres. He had no childhood. They had to leave. They had to leave their house, open the door, and walk out. And that was it. That's how they left. Along the way, his sister died of starvation. And his mother, she gave him a tin cup and a tin spoon. And she said, "Don't let anybody eat from this. This is all I can do for you, my son."
It was enough. Karsh arrived in Canada in 1925, where he lived with his photographer uncle, George Nakash, who inspired him to take photos. And on December 30th, 1941, age 32, his life was forever changed when Winston Churchill visited Ottawa.
This was during 1941, the most terrible time of the war. Britain was on the verge of giving up. The Nazis were bombing the hell out of England. London was in tatters. And one of the little Nazi prime ministers said, "Oh, we will wring the neck of England like a chicken." And Churchill gets up and addressed the two houses of parliament in Canada and says, "Some chicken, some neck." And Churchill gives this ringing speech, and everybody is very high. And he walks triumphantly to the speaker's chamber. He does not know that he's going to be photographed. Nobody has told him. And Yousef has been up like for hours, you know, checking his camera.
At this point, Churchill is quite upset. No one told him he's being photographed. They give him some brandy, a cigar, and he finally cooperates. Estralita Karsh.
And he says to him, "You may take one. One." So Churchill's standing there, humph, humph, and he's puffing away at his cigar, puff, puff. So Yousef takes an ashtray, and he prefers it, and Churchill would not hear of it. He just hung on to that cigar like dear life, and he says, go ahead, take the picture. And Yousef didn't say anything, and he got everything ready, and he reached out and he snatched the cigar from his lips and said, "Forgive me, sir." And that was the picture.
Karsh's career exploded. He went on to photograph Helen Keller, Martin Luther King Jr., Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, Walt Disney. Okay, this list is so good, I'm going to give you a few more. Albert Einstein, Grace Kelly, Jackie Robinson, Ingrid Bergman, Ernest Hemingway, Muhammad Ali, Jackie Onassis, and Thomas Watson, who applied the trademark business methods he learned at National Cash Register to transform Dayton Computing Scale Company into IBM. These images, alongside numerous others, are currently at the Dayton Art Institute. They showcase Karsh's unique gift of humanizing celebrities.
Yes, he was very technically brilliant, I mean, obviously. But what his subjects wanted to give him, was themselves.
And give of themselves they did. For a brief moment, some of the world's most famous people let down their guards and allowed an Armenian refugee, a man who escaped unthinkable bloodshed and terror, to illuminate their true characters.
I mean, where it would have been fine for him to sit on the analyst's couch and bemoan everything, he didn't.
Rather than letting the horror of his past limit him, it seems Yusef Karsh used it for good, as a means to channel a sort of grace toward people, to make them feel like, sure, they were great. But in the grand scheme of things, that didn't really matter. They didn't have to be. All they had to be was themselves. For WYSO, I'm Community Voices producer Leo DeLuca.
The Yusef Karsh exhibit is called American Portraits, and it's at the Dayton Art Institute until September 16th. Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. That's it for WISO Weekend. This week, anyway. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Thanks for joining us. Coming up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.